Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast, and we are back for another great episode with a return guest that we're excited to talk to. Without any further ado, we're just going to get right to it. Dennis, how you doing, fella?
Doing great. Doing really good. Excited about our episode tonight.
Now, I know you and our guest are in Texas. I'm in Florida. It's been cold all over the planet. So for those of you up in the north, the Midwest, who are freezing, granted, we're not freezing as bad as you are, but we feel the pain, too. I was just explaining to Dennis and Dan here that it's supposed to feel like 28 degrees in Florida tomorrow morning. It's 42 right now. So hopefully while you're drinking your coffee and driving to work tomorrow with your heater blasted on high, you're listening to the show and perhaps a good topic about subtropical climates will warm up your soul. Without any further ado, Dennis, let's get to it.
Yeah, so we're very excited to have with us again a friend of mine and a tremendous author, Dan King, who has got himself a very unique niche in World War II history. And what's awesome about it is that it just kind of sprang into being. And it was a love of history, and I'll let him tell his own story. But I am all about that, about the universe giving you signs, and you hopefully paying attention to them, and taking advantage of the opportunities you're given, and just what wild rides that will take you on. This is in particular one of those human stories that I love so much. Dan's written several books, Blossoms from the Sky, firsthand accounts from the Japanese naval pilots who volunteered to fly the Okabaka bomb, The Yellow River Boys, and that one's about Dan's father's aircraft, the B-29 cruise, and that's the Korean War. A Tomb Called Iwo Jima, that's a book that I referenced a lot when I was doing my book with Mitch Weiss, The Heart of Hell, specifically because, and this is what we're going to get into, is that there are viewpoints from the Japanese side, and that's what Dan is all about. And that is amazing. The Last Zero Fighter. And then this one here, The Iron Graves of Saipan, and that's his newest book. And I've enjoyed it. I've got mine all marked up and dog-eared and highlighted. And I've even got notes that I've written in the margins here. So we're very glad to have you with us, Dan. And thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you. I appreciate it a lot. And thanks for helping promote my book, The Iron Graves of Saipan. I want to say the photo on the back I took on Saipan about a year and a half ago. And this was the training range for the 4th Tank Company on Lalau Beach. And this is where they actually fired at mock targets for General Saito, who praised them and gave them all like a special liberty pass. But I thought it was just so amazing to stand on this beautiful, quiet, solemn beach and know that, you know, back in 1944, they were blasting away at American mock-up tanks on this beach. So there's all those kind of stories here in that book.
Speaking of that photo, and it never really occurred to me before, but speaking of that photo, when you're reading or researching areas and you find historical documentation about battlegrounds or battlefields, area where an attack happens, do they often list the latitudes and longitude, which would then help us modern day find those areas with GPS? Or is it a little more treasure hunting involved in that?
Yeah, there's a lot of treasure hunting. There's like locations as far as, from what I've seen, like on the Japanese side, it's tougher to find longitude and latitudes. But this is a pretty famous beach there in Saipan.
And real quick, to Dennis's opening point, I agree with him wholeheartedly. I love the way, not only in this book, but in your other books, how you're presenting the story from a side that often that people aren't used to. You know, if you live in America, you tend to read American-based books about what the Army, the Marine Corps, Airborne did. And if you live in UK, oftentimes you read the Allied side as well. And sometimes when you do read from the axis of evil, quote unquote, or the enemy side, mm-hmm. sometimes it's done, but it still kind of feels a little propaganda-ish. Whereas yours, right. You tell an honest open-eyed. Like this is about the Japanese viewpoint of the Battle of Saipan. But at no point do I, as a reader, feel like there's any sort of, pro-Japanese, pro-axis of evil propaganda or storytelling here. This is just a straight, this is what happened to these guys. This is what they went through. This is their
Right.
experience. It's a true, honest telling. And
I'm so glad to hear that.
it's very reminiscent of what we heard the guys at the beginning of Band of Brothers say. Hey, we're not talking about the SS guys, but we realize that if we weren't at war and if we were somewhere else, maybe fishing or on vacation,
Right.
they're
Oh,
just
yeah.
like us. We would get along. And that's what you walk away with this book. And
Yes.
we'll get into it. And one of the early scenes of that, which I really enjoyed, was when you get into talking about the boot camp, them going to the post exchange, buying the candy and the different things. You really take that boogeyman aspect away, and you're like, these are just young men who were fighting for their country, much like we were fighting for ours. And I really appreciate that. And we need more of
Oh,
that
thanks.
so people get a well-rounded view of these campaigns and the tragedy on both sides, really.
Yeah, I definitely enjoyed talking to the Japanese veterans and hearing about their experiences. And like you said, if you met them at a different time or location, you'd probably be friends with them. And they, in their mindset, they were told that an enemy is coming to take over the country. What does every red-blooded Japanese man do? Defends the country. Anybody would do that. And that's what they were told. That's what they believed. And of course, the propaganda told them the Americans were bloodthirsty, demons, monsters. They were going to eat your babies and do all this crazy stuff. So, a lot of their kamikaze attacks and their last-ditch efforts totally make sense. If you think you're the last line of defense between your mom and your sister and your little brother being destroyed or mutilated, barbecued, then of course you'll give up your life for that. Anybody would. I don't care whether you're American, Russian, Chinese, Canadian. Any normal patriotic person would give their life to defend their family and their friends. It's a very normal attitude. And as Americans, I grew up hearing that Japanese were crazy, the kamikazes, and they were drunk, and they were like chained to their cockpit so they couldn't get out, and they had. And all these stories, because our mindset just couldn't understand that they were just like us in that way, that they wanted to defend their homelands. And I think being able to talk to the veterans in their own language, and then I could read their letters that they would send me, because I also read and write Japanese. And then I would always promise them, I'll tell your story. I will not add anything. I will not deduct anything. So if you tell me something that happened to you, I'll put it in, and I won't try to make it more dramatic, or I won't try to make you look like a good person or a bad person. I'll just share what you tell me. And I think over time, I got more introductions from other veterans. They would say, "Oh yeah, don't worry, he's okay," because the Japanese veterans hate journalists in Japan. They hate the media, because the media almost always, from what they said to me, is that they take our stories and they twist them and they make us look like bad guys. In the media, everything is Nanking. Even in the Japanese media, everything is Nanking, Nanking, Nanking. And the Japanese veterans I met were like, I never went to China. I flew an aircraft, in Saipan, and I don't know anything about what happened over there. But what I did was honorable and right. And I'm proud of what I did.
Dennis,
So.
you and Dan both interviewed a lot of people as well as I, and I just had another thought too. The fact that you spoke the language and wrote the language, it had to help so tremendously. And for the audience at home, here's the best way I can describe it. If you ever see and somebody doing an interview via satellite, like on a big news channel, there's a buffer, right? There's a delay. Well, if you're trying to interview these Japanese survivors and you're doing it through a translator, you got to tell the translator question, they got to translate it. But when you're speaking directly, the timing's there, the intimacy is
Right,
there. You're
right.
the survivor's telling a story, and he might be on the cusp of breaking through. But when he's got to pause, wait for the translator, and then you two, and then you, it breaks up the story. It breaks up the timing. It breaks up
Right.
the authenticity and the intimacy of it. So that probably led to more natural memories
Yeah.
that occurred out of nowhere, whereas if they had to sit there and wait, that memory would have
Right.
slipped away.
I found that true. Like, if I talk to the veteran and he'll tell me a story and he'll mention something, I was like, wait, what was that? And then he'll just go right into it. Whereas if you had to use a translator, that person has to kind of filter what was said. And the thing is, like being a World War II nerd, right? So I know all the special language that the veterans use. I know what they call like a bayonet. They call it a gobo root, right? A gobo root is real long, and they use it to a burdock root. And they'll say, "Oh, I grabbed my burdock root," and I blah blah blah. And I go, "Oh yeah, you're Type 30 bayonet." And they go, "Oh yeah, that's right." But if you go through a translator, they say, "Oh, why you have a burdock root? Why you have a gobo root? Oh, why you have a pumpkin? Oh, why you have?" And they don't know all the phrases and
And then they're
terms that
looking at you
you.
saying he's doing a bonsai charge with a vegetable.
Yeah,
So yeah.
vegetable. What's going on? So, and the way they ch tied their chin straps is very unique. They imitated the samurai style of tying those 2-foot-long chin straps that went around twice and made a little bow. All these little details of how they wrapped their leggings, these little things that they would talk about. And I noticed, like, if I gave the guy a pair of leggings, I said, "Do you still know how to tie these?" And he would start tying them, and then a lot of memories would flood back. And it was really like the
Wow.
body connected to the mind. And there was one veteran, he's going to be in a later book, but he committed a lot of war crimes in China. But I gave him a pair of leggings I bought at a flea market, and he put one on in about 30 seconds, just like so fast. He just tied it, it was solid and tight. And he started the second one, and then he stopped. And he said, "I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this." And he unrolled it, unwrapped it, made it real tight again, handed it back to me. And he said, "Too many bad memories about this." And then I, well, like, what happened? And then he started talking about it. And then that led to the story that'll be in a future book. It's very
Wow.
sad and scary. But this book is just about Saipan
For
and about the
continuity's
tank.
sake,
Wow.
this book, The Iron Graves of Saipan. Now, on a previous episode, you kind of led into how this project came to be. So, for our new listening audience, let's discuss how you got to meet this vet and because of your authenticity and your demand to make sure that representation of some tanks in a movie and your role as a historical advisor on a Hollywood movie led to this book. So if we could, for our new audience, bring that up and then we'll go into the book.
Well, I've done a lot of consulting for History Channel shows and various documentaries and Hollywood movies and things. And one of them was the movie Wind Talkers. And I was hired as the Japanese consultant. So the director, John Woo, gave me carte blanche to control like all aspects, like the uniforms, the markings on the vehicles, the tanks, what kind of weapons are used, all that. It was really great. So I provided the correct tank markings for the 9th Tank Regiment to the property department when they were building these tanks. And I went out to check them one day in Hawaii at the warehouse. And this is just a few months before filming. And I noticed that the Japanese tanks were just like painted up with flags on the side, like any old 1950s Hollywood movie would do. And I asked the guy, I said, "What happened to the authentic markings I gave you?" He said, "Oh, they're here somewhere. That's no big deal. It's just Jap tanks and no one's going to know." And I said, no. What if a Japanese soldier watches this movie and recognizes the unit markings on the tank and then tells everyone in Japan, wouldn't that be great marketing?" And he's like, "Yeah, I guess. But, it's going to take like a whole day to redo it all." And I said, "Okay, I'm just going to go tell, the director why you didn't have it, okay." And he's like, okay. So he redid it. And I appreciate that a lot. I'm very
Yes,
grateful.
yeah, for sure.
Because, like, the next year, I'm at home and I get an email from a man who told me that he took a Japanese tanker veteran to go see the movie Wind Talkers in Osaka. And the old gentleman was sitting there in the theater and watched the tanks go by, and the correct markings were on the tanks. And he jumped up and said, "My tanks!" And he was so excited that he asked the man who took him to find out who was in charge. And they found me through the internet and he invited me to come to Osaka to talk to him about the Battle of Saipan. So the next a few months later, I went to Japan and I got to meet him, and he was like shaking my hand. He's like, "Oh, those were my friends that died in that tank. Oh, I can't thank you enough." And it turns out he was the one who brought the tank back from Saipan that's on display at the Yasukuni Shrine. And his eyes were glazed over and he was shaking my hand. And so I said, your story deserved to be turned into a book." So he started telling me his stories, and we started writing letters back and forth, and another interview a couple years later, and it blossomed into this book. And all
So
because I was a stickler for details. If it had been just a Japanese flag painted on the side of the turret that flashed by, Japanese veteran would have said, "Yeah, well, typical Americans, you know, what are you gonna do?" And they would have just stopped right there. I never would have met him, and this book never would have come to be.
Yeah,
Yeah,
it
so
never would have been.
I was very, 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 very grateful and very thankful for that.
Gosh, those little details.
I know it's
Man.
I love that stuff. And you know, as like when I write books, I write them for myself. I always think, what kind of book would I want to read? What kind of details do I want to learn about? Like, what do they eat? What do they drink? Did they ever get in fights? Did they have little parties or celebrations? And in the book, you know, I talk about the special like sporting events they had and how they dressed up in costumes and they dressed up like women, you know, for this special festival day and all this stuff that the average American wouldn't think about. You think, oh, the Japanese would never do that. They never put on lipstick and pretend to be women, or they'd never wear these funny frog costumes, and or they'd never have you know, relay rallies or running, you know, against each other to get, you know, a sake bottle for a prize. And they wouldn't fight and they wouldn't steal from each other, heavens no. But they did all that. And so people, I think you read that, you kind of go, well, they're not that different.
Yeah, at the
You
end of
know,
the
they're,
day, they're 18, 19-year-old boys.
yeah, they're young guys. They're hungry, so they stole food.
And
You know?
just like in the United States with our 18, 19-year-old boys, joining the military, some of the first time these guys have been out of their villages, their little towns, they're a little part of that island,
Right.
and they're experiencing life just like our boys did.
Right. They're getting seasick on a ship. You know, and these all these little details you don't think about. And but when the veterans tell their stories to me, I record everything on an audio disc, right? And I also take notes. And then I write back and forth with them afterwards just to confirm things because I have questions a lot of times. And I like to hear about like their parents, their families, their sisters, their brothers, and the little personal details without trying to glorify them, without trying to make them look like victims of war or because, you know, they're not, right? They were soldiers. It's to give a little warmer personal understanding of what they were like.
Wow.
Go ahead, Dennis.
Have a two-part question. The Japanese, the accounts that I've read, many of the Japanese talk about the brutality of their basic training.
Yes.
So my first question is that true? Is that kind of universal for them? And then two, if you could expand on that and talk about if you think it made them better soldiers in the long run, or if you think it maybe was detrimental to their unit cohesion and whatnot, or whatnot.
Yeah, I think their education system started off really young with that discipline and then obedience to orders. And as elementary school students, they had to stand up in the classroom, right, to address the teacher, show respect to the teacher, bow to the portrait of the emperor. And they had their PE classes involve military drill and marching and saluting and marching with training rifles. So from the time they were, you know, 7, 8 years old, they were already got that mindset going of becoming soldiers. And that was just part of life. As you went to school, you served in the military for 2 years or 3 years if you're in the Navy, the Army, and then you went on, you got a wife, you got married, you got a job. It was just part of your life. It was expected. And in the military, they were very harsh about hierarchies and about instant obedience. And there was no discussion, there was no democracy, and they meted out attitude corrections with the open palm slap and then the closed hand punch. And almost every veteran I ever talked to, if I'd say, grit your teeth, they'd go like this. Then they'd laugh because they knew a punch was coming.
Wow.
Because the NCO would say, grit your teeth, because they don't want to break your teeth. So you bite your teeth down and you wait, and then you take it. And you get knocked down. And if you don't get up right away, then you get another. So they would tighten their teeth and like prepare for a punch that I wouldn't give them, of course. But then they would kind of smile and laugh and go, oh, I didn't like that at all. You know, punched around, slapped around. But it taught them like instant obedience to orders for anyone,
We
even if they're just
saw
one rank above you.
We saw in Korea in particular the mass with the Chinese, the mass just flow of troops being thrown at hills. And I guess my question is more of, does it make them to where they're not allowed to be, for instance, I think the American model was that if the captain is killed, the lieutenant takes command. If the lieutenant's killed,
Right.
the master sergeant takes command. If the master sergeant is killed, even on down to PFC, they all know the mission and they're all allowed to make decisions on how to fulfill the mission and make command decisions. And it was that the same with the Japanese army? Is did it break down that way, or was it?
It to me, it seemed like once the battle started and the movement was going forward, it didn't matter who was in command. You all had the mission. Everyone knew we're supposed to go to that hill. And even if you're the only guy who makes it there, it's your job to go there. And of course, in the Japanese army, if you have one more star than me, PFC versus a private, then I have to obey every order you give me. You're my superior commander, even if we're fellow enlisted men. So they were pretty, that hierarchy was very strict. And I think on one hand, it made them, it took away their ability for creative thought and spot judgments, as that they were just told to move one way and act one way and listen to orders. Whereas maybe an American GI had had more life experience, I want to say, as a student, and dealing with cars and farm equipment and going on dances and dates and things like that that give you more ability to think in different situations. Whereas the Japanese were very strict on their education system.
Yeah, I was thinking, you were mentioning the childhood. They started early with the standing, the saluting, and all that. Obviously, it's not the ideal childhood, but from the military standpoint, when you already have your inductees into your boot camp, if you will, already having that training, that gets
Oh, for
past
sure.
2 weeks of breaking them in, right?
Oh, for
We don't
sure.
have that. So the first, few days or week or whatever it is, an American boot camp, it's break them down, build
Oh,
them up, teach
yeah.
them how to soldier. But and for them, that's already been done. It's been done
They're
for
all done.
12,
All
13
done.
years. So
All
now you just
done.
get right to
Right.
the brass tacks.
Exactly. They knew how to shoot guns and machine guns and rifles. They knew how to tie their leggings. They knew how to wear the backpacks and the haversacks and the canteens, and they knew how to march in orders and move in squads. And they had, that's just part of their PE class. And they had military soldiers, reservists in each school, in each class, in charge of teaching each group of boys. And so they were exposed to seeing guys in uniform every day at school. It seemed very common, very normal to them. Guys, holding swords and the uniforms, the whole deal. So there was no resistance to obeying orders because that's how you did it as a kid from the time they were little.
There's this, and exactly that point, what we were talking about on page 92 in your book, and forgive me for mispronouncing names and whatnot, but you write, there was a loud bang. Shimoda's driver barked, "We're hit. The engine's dead." The crew commander screamed, "Everybody out." Shimoda passed his machine gun up through the turret and grabbed an armful of magazines. He and the others slid down the tank and crawled into an infantry trench. With colorful tracers snapping overhead, they watched a Chiha roll past. The markings identified it as from the 3rd Tank Company's 2nd Tank Platoon. The tank suddenly stopped as smoke and flames bellowed from the engine compartment. Sergeant Kawakami climbed out of his burning tank, drew his sword, jumped down, and ran forward. Gripping his machine gun, Shimoda rose up on one knee, but Sergeant Nakao hauled him back down, saying, "Stop! Don't be in such a hurry to die. The fight has just begun. Trust me." Nakao was a grizzled combat veteran of the Nemohan incident and knew what he was doing. He ordered his crew to keep their heads down. Angry tears of frustration rolled down Shimoda's cheeks as squads of infantrymen ran past them, only to be mowed down like wheat. Man.
Yeah, he recalled that to me, and when he was telling that story, I could see his eyes were like fixated on a point in the distance, and he was just remembering it and telling me, and he could hear it and smell it and feel it, And I felt like I'm watching something be replayed in someone's head. It was fascinating to me.
Just to provide a little context for our audience when it comes to the Iron Graves of Saipan, basically we follow the story of the veteran that you spoke to after after he saw your premiere, and we basically follow him from pre-military through boot camp through the battle. Just for the sake of our audience, introduce them to your main character and just give us the little overview so that when we're talking about these excerpts from the book, they're kind of known who we're talking about.
Oh, his name is Shiro Shimoda, and he enlisted in the army. He wanted to be a tanker, and he was assigned to the 9th Tank Regiment, 3rd Tank Company, headquarters platoon, and it was stationed in Manchuria on the border with Russia. And so he spent about 2 years enduring the icy cold weather, and they trained in the heat of the summer and the freezing cold, icy winters, expecting to fight against the Russians. And their whole mindset was the enemy is Russia. And so with time they were small children, the enemy was always Russia. 1904 or 5 Russia war was with Russia. And they beat the Russians in the Baltic Sea, and all their heroes had fought against Russians. And so that mindset was against Russians. And so they didn't prepare for any kind of tropical warfare or tropical fighting or anything in that mindset. And when they received their orders to transfer away from Manchuria, they assumed they're going back to Japan to participate in like a victory parade of the Emperor's birthday or something, and then go back to Manchuria. Then they found themselves being sent to Guam and Saipan. And the commander of the unit, Colonel Goshima, had to scramble because he had no training on defending an island, no training on defending against naval artillery because they didn't have it in Manchuria. And there would be no battleships firing at him in Manchuria. And so he had to rush to try to scramble and get maps and charts and information from one of his former staff at the Army Officers Academy. And it seemed like so haphazard and so disorganized and so rushed. And I felt like, well, these guys are just being right sent into a situation that's no good for them. And they had to bring all their own food supplies, ammunition, medical supplies, oil, gas, grease, spare tracks, tanks. And they filled these ships up. They just stuffed everything in there and just rushed to get them down to Saipan as fast as they could. And once they got there, they had to set up. They set up in the school buildings because the school buildings already had water, electricity. They kicked all the kids out of the school buildings because Saipan had decades of, colonizers, right? Workers there. They had elementary school, Boy Scouts, tennis clubs, everything, just like a regular Japanese town. So these tankers went in and they took over all the elementary schools and set up their buildings there. And they started digging tunnels as fast as they could, hoping to get underground before the Americans showed up.
To that point, when I was reading the book and you're talking about the sugarcane plantations and that infrastructure, it raises another one of those questions. How different would this battle have been if there was no sugarcane plantations, if there was no infrastructure, no school buildings, no warehousing for shipping, packing? As you just said, you're talking about them scrambling, hey, we've been training for Manchuria, now we're going to Saipan. If only there was a 1928 National Geographic with Saipan maps on it, like there was Guadalcanal, man, they could have had a little support. But how much different do you think this battle would have been if it would have just been an island with nothing but the opportunity to build an airport or staging area and not have all that valuable infrastructure there?
Oh, that's a good point. I never thought about that. Those civilians were definitely very unlucky folks getting caught up in all that, because they were just there as regular Japanese, regular Koreans, regular Taiwanese, who were promised, 40 acres and a mule. You come to Saipan and you get to farm your land, you get to make money, sell the sugarcane back to the company, and they call that the land of eternal summer. We coconuts, pineapples, papaya, it's bonita fish and great sunsets. And the brochures that they gave out to people to get them to immigrate to Saipan were amazing. And it was this tropical, wonderful paradise. They would have no idea that it'd be a battle zone later on. So the place was filled with schools, churches, temples, you name it. And I think when the Americans arrived, all those people had like nowhere to go, so they rushed into the hillsides and were trying to squeeze into every little nook and cranny they could get into, and a lot of them were victims of the war, and actually kind of slowed down the Japanese defense because they had all these hordes of people rushing to the roads trying to get away from the battle, and the Japanese soldiers are trying to get to the battle, and it actually was, I guess, to our benefit that it messed up their infrastructure because of all the civilians were moving around. But I have a lot of empathy for those folks who were just regular farmers, regular people trying to eke out an existence on Saipan.
That was, I wrote that short story about what the end result of all that, the Banzai Cliff, but that what stood out to me too was that, but the civilians caught on, the civilians that survived were the ones who caught on quick that at night we need to lay low and quit moving. Because, and that was very evident too in reading that the smart civilians would yell out to the other ones, "Hey, you're gonna make noise and you're gonna get killed by either side." So,
There's
and then
some.
they wouldn't listen, or they were desperate, or they were hungry, or they, so they would keep moving, and then you would hear that tut, 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 tut. And sure enough, the next morning they'd go and they'd find their friends and neighbors were killed. Exactly what you're talking about.
Well, maybe
And
that's a
it
good
just
question for the both of you, since you've both written books on Saipan and the impact on the civilian population. Do you guys feel that when it comes to the Battle of Saipan, that the scale of the civilian population is often overlooked by historians or the people creating the content or the media about that particular battle?
I think so. There was a lot of innocent people there, a lot of children, a lot of families, a lot of elderly people there who I think are just kind of overlooked. And we focus on the valor and the courage of the two fighting forces. And there are a lot of stories written by Japanese survivors who are civilians, and a lot of them are like teenagers or younger, and they talk about the battle from their viewpoint. And I tried to blend some of that into my book, but I still got to focus on Mr. Shimoda and his unit, because my book's not about the Battle for Saipan. It's not about the Marianas. It's about this tank unit and about this one tanker who's in this one tank. And I tried to keep it without, otherwise the mission scope gets way too wide.
Absolutely.
Right.
What's up, guys? As you all know, I am a huge bass kayak fishing fan. I love to bass fish from my kayak. And so, if you're like me, when you first got into fishing, you started looking online for some bait casters, perhaps some spinning rods, spinning reels, and you got sticker shock. You could not believe how expensive this quality stuff is. And that's how I got turned on to Cass King. I started looking for high-end quality fishing equipment that people could afford. And that is Cass King's, that's their slug line, affordable fishing innovation. And they tell the truth. I enjoyed their fishing equipment so much that I went out and initiated contact with Cass King to become an ambassador. I have been an ambassador now for 2.5 years. I don't bring it up a lot. But hey, I just want to say to y'all, if you want to help support the show, you're looking for some quality fishing equipment, head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com/fish. Click on the link, check out the Cass King gear. You'll be happy you did. I'll get a little bit of thank you from Cass King. You're supporting the show. We're all happy. Thank you so much. Now on to the show.
Yeah, that was very evident to me in when writing about Saipan and the Marianas myself, and the research I did on my grandfather's gunboat group. And that research is when I first heard about the suicide cliffs at Marpeet Point in Saipan. And I just heard the sailors talking about islands of bodies floating. And I thought, surely they are exaggerating. And then there was just so many accounts, and it was like, oh man. But Don, and to answer your question too that you posed, I mean, it was their story was so glaringly not told that I felt that I needed to make it the first of my short story series, their story, because it just, and especially that Japanese pastor at the end of my book there, who who goes there to the cliffs, and he hears the voices crying out to him in the 1980s for them not to be forgotten. And you know, that sealed the deal for me. And I was like, okay, well, I am definitely going to make my little attempt to make sure that those folks are not forgotten and just devote it to them. But you know, when I read about books like this, and everyone really focuses, caught a lot of attention is focused on Europe, the European theater. And the Pacific, for some reason, has always been the books. If you were to stack the books of Europe against the books from the Pacific War, there's a glaring disparity there in the numbers. And the reality is that the Pacific for America is where it started. And those battles were one thing that I really like, and another thing that our countries and other countries always do is they try and demonize the enemy, right? They make him into the boogeyman. They make him, the Japanese in the posters always had really thick glasses and buck teeth, and they couldn't see, and they couldn't fly, and they couldn't see at night, and this and
Sure. But to be a
that.
little fair to all governments, because they all do that, right? If you're trying to
Yeah,
get your
all the
civilian
governments do that.
population to stomach war so that they quote unquote support it by going to work and fueling the machines of war, you have to kind of dehumanize your enemy or your populace is not going to be down for the cause. And so regardless of what the United States, Japan, China, but yeah, I mean, that is the key component of propaganda on all sides is we got to dehumanize the enemy in order to for our populace to stomach this movement, whatever it may be.
Well, in Saipan, the Marines were said by the Japanese, the Marines were said to be murderers and cannibals and rapists, and you had to murder your family to become a Marine. But what I love about one of the things that I love about the two movies that Clint Eastwood made, Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima, if folks, you talk to folks who have seen both, almost to a person, they all will say that they enjoyed Letters from Iwo Jima more. And that is the case with me as well. I actually wept.
Yeah, because it's fresh eyes on a story you know before.
I actually wept. And because Clint Eastwood brilliantly made them personal, and that's what you do here. Dan, in page 59, you say, in his farewell letter to his father, Shun used courtly, formal honorifics to convey his appreciation to his parents for bringing him into the world and for taking such good care of him. He expressed his remorse that he would be unable to repay them for their kindness in their older years as a good son should. He ended the letter by stating that he, quote, made the decision to serve the nation faithfully without regrets, even if it meant becoming a corpse in the battlefield. And you end that with this one sentence: his body was never recovered. Yeah. Those kind of sentences there, it sounds like it was written by some kid from Ohio.
No, yeah, definitely. They love their parents. They love their brothers and sisters, and they love their country, and they are proud of their country, and they wanted to be remembered as warriors as their fathers were, and their grandfathers were, and their great grandfathers were, and it was they're just the next to step in line to do their duty to defend the nation. And as you said earlier, the Americans were portrayed as these monsters, right, who would kill and destroy and eat the babies and all this other stuff. So the civilians were told, do not let yourself become captured because they'll do horrible things to you. And so, I was talking to Guy Gabaldon many years ago when I visited Saipan. And we had a really nice long talk about the stuff that he saw, people jumping off the cliffs and throwing babies off the cliffs. And he was trying to yell at them to stop. He was like trying to wound this one lady in the leg to get her to, so she wouldn't make it to the cliff, right? And he was just so angry that these people believed the lies that the Americans would hurt them. And he wanted to help them. And he just was so angry at the government. So whenever he referred to Japanese civilians, he would call them Japanese. But when he referred to the government or the soldiers, he used the shorter, the term that we're not usually familiar saying to each other, So he said there's different. There's this innocent civilian Japanese people who I love, and I wanted to help them as civilians, even as a Marine. But then you had the soldiers who were lying to them, and I hated them, and I wanted to kill them. And it was so evident the way he was so passionate about that.
Do you mind telling our listeners about him? Because I know the name, and I know he was, I think, called the Pied Piper of Saipan.
Piper of Saipan. Yeah, he
Do you mind telling our listeners
sure.
about him?
Yeah, he was a Marine who went to language school because he had some Japanese American friends growing up in LA. And he went to Camp Elliott, and he learned how to speak Japanese grammatically accurately and to learn basic writing in Japanese. He became a recon guy, 2nd Marine Division, wound up on Saipan, and he was going out on recon missions from the very beginning, and he was trying to get Japanese to surrender. Figured if I got them to give up, then I don't have to kill them later. So he was credited with bringing in over 800 people, men, women, children, everyone. And he was recommended for the Navy Cross. He got downgraded to the Silver Star, and he was wounded pretty bad on Saipan. That's another whole, it's in the book too. But it was interesting to me is how much he loved and admired the people while hating the soldiers so much. You see, he had the Dr. Jekyll Hyde personality with flip. He really hated the soldiers, and he talked about shooting them and killing them and doing all kinds of things to the enemy soldiers, but wanting to carry out the children, help the babies, and help the people, and to tell them, we're not here to hurt you, we're here to save you and help you. So I thought he was just an amazing person. He's written a couple of books. I think one's called America Betrayed. And if you go online, you can find both of his books. And they were going to do a remake of a movie that was about him in the 50s. And he told me that they were in the process of negotiations, but they wanted to take out a lot of the language and soften a lot of the battle scenes, but he refused and he wouldn't sign off on it. And so it never happened.
We kind of touched on government and hating government. Obviously, we want people to read the book, so we're not going to give too much away. But you mentioned earlier that this particular vet was responsible for the recovery of a tank. What I thought was interesting is when he set out to do that mission, he found some tanks that were basically buried, covered up, and forgotten about by the local populace. And as it seems to happen a lot, once somebody with some interest and some abilities and some means shows interest in something, all the people who want to get their beak wet come out, and all of a sudden, now something that's been forgot about, pushed over here, and just get it out of the way for 30 years. Now it's whoa, whoa, settle down. This is valuable to us. This
We
represents our
need
history.
this.
Really? It's been buried under here for 30 years. I can only, when you're interviewing him and he's talking about that stage of his life, did that frustration still carry through all these years later when reminiscing about what the government was doing to try to prevent him
He
from?
was not happy. He was not happy with the way he was treated by both sides. And when he was talking about that tank, it was in a trash dump covered up with all sorts of garbage where they set it on fire. Because back then it was a different world and people just burned their trash in big piles on Saipan on the beach. And when they drove past it, a cab driver was taking him and his wife to Saipan for the first time since the war. And he just wanted to go back and look at everything and kind of pray for his friends and just kind of see what was still there. And then he sees that top of a tank sticking out of a massive pile of garbage, and it just destroyed him. And he couldn't believe how that had not been rescued or couldn't be rescued or pulled out of the garbage. So that's a whole long saga that he went through, and he was not able to rescue that tank. It's still on Saipan. But it was pulled out of the garbage, and now it sits where the 2nd Marine Division landed on top of a concrete bunker. So he was proud of the fact that he got it out of the garbage, got it cleaned down and painted, and it's like a display now. But how he found the other two tanks is almost like he attributes it to kind of like a spiritual, like ghosts reaching out to him or something from the other side helping him to make this happen against all odds, against the Japanese government, the US government, the Saipan government, where no one was really helping him that much. And it still managed to pull it off.
And at that
Wow.
point, this was what, 1982,
70s,
1975?
yeah, 1970. He went on his honeymoon, took her to Saipan. And she was like, oh, Hawaii sounds wonderful. He goes, no, we're going to Saipan. She's like, what? And I went to Saipan in 92, and there was nothing there. Like, there wasn't one street light. It's
Well,
not what it looks like today.
Well, the
And
reason I bring the time that the years that this happened,
right.
it's not like nowadays where you can get online and call a company to come out with one of those ground printed trading radars to
Right,
grid out
right,
a football
right,
field and
right.
find. He's literally out there with a backhoe and a hunch.
Yes.
And it was literally, okay, I'm told some old timers believe it's over here.
Oh, here in this area, and you have 2 days to dig. That's all we're giving you. And he had to rent all the backhoes and pay all the workers and buy the gas and hell. And they're like, "Oh, let's try here." And they found a U.S. tank. They're like, "Oh, close, no cigar." And they had to cover that up. And they had to try another spot. And that's why he was feeling that it's somehow something was guiding him and helping him. And his son was with him, so he that turned into this like father-son adventure. Where the son got to go travel his father's footsteps back to Saipan and help his dad discover the old tanks. And of course, we found the name of the crew who died in there, and there were some bones in one of them. And it was a very emotional experience for that father and son. And I felt like, well, I got to see this. I got to witness this. And they're both gone. Mr. Shimoda and his son are both gone. But I'm happy to be able to share their story and tell it to people who also like those kind of adventure stories. Those father and son stories. And he was only there was out of his company, he was the only guy. That's it. One guy. Out of the whole third company, everyone gone. Just
Man.
Mr. Shimoda. Out of the whole regiment, there was only 30. 20
Wow.
from Saipan, 10 from Guam. That's it. So
Man.
there wasn't like he had a whole community of fellow survivors to help him. And his
Speaking of
dedication
that,
was.
a lot of times when we interview historians, especially when it comes to the Allied stuff, a lot of their research is, at least, 20 years ago, a lot of it was accompanied or assisted by veterans groups getting together every couple of years for anniversaries or reunions. But oftentimes when you're a veteran of the military who quote unquote lost a war, sometimes their modern day military or the civilians have less of a interest in preserving those
Right.
memories.
Right.
When it comes to the Japanese civilians and the veterans and
Right.
the modern day military, how does that hold up comparatively speaking to some maybe the modern allies groups?
Yeah, they started making their veterans groups like in the 70s and 80s. And before that, the guys were too busy just trying to make a living and to survive in the post-war Japan. And they didn't really talk about their war because they'd lost it, right? And there was no glory or honor talking about the war. And a lot of the veterans, the Japanese veterans, were treated kind of like our Vietnam veterans were. And they were disrespected and they were ignored and they were, "You lost the war. Look what you did. You guys started the war. You got our country destroyed." So, but with Mr. Shimoto's group, there were the 30 survivors who survived combat, plus there were another 40 or 50 or so who didn't go to combat, who stayed in Manchuria, who hadn't completed their training. So when he found the tank and brought it back to Tokyo, they had this big giant reunion and they all got to reunite with each other. And they all started sharing their stories and sharing their letters and their diaries, and they made a nice big thick unit history, which I was able to get, a copy
Wow.
from him and read through all this information that's not public anywhere, even in Japan.
Yeah.
Unless you have that unit history, you're not going to know. So I have information that's in my book that's not even in Japanese books because they didn't have that.
Wow.
And one of the biggest contentions was the commander of the 9th Tank Regiment, his name is Goshima. His last name is Goshima. But everywhere in the US and Japan, he's called Goto. The Marine Corps history books, US history books in schools, online, Wikipedia, everywhere you go, his name is Colonel Tadao Goto.
Why is that? Where did that stem from?
Yeah, where did that
And
come
that
from?
was, the Japanese writing system is they use called kanji characters, and they'll put their names together. And Goshima means five islands. Go Shima. But the word island is also pronounced to. Like now we say Iwo Jima, but the Japanese also say Iwoto. So the word island can be pronounced Shima, Jima, or To. And so when the Nisei translators back in 1944 on Saipan, when they discovered documents with the Colonel Goshiwa's name on them, they just naturally read it as Goto, because To was the most common pronunciation of the word island. So that got pushed and then corrected and copied and copied and copied and copied. Through the decades, it just became Goto became, but in the unit history, they mention that and they say, no, it's Goshima. And they put the little hiragana next to the kanji, goes to two spots. They put it Goshima. And then Mr. Shimoda said, hey, remember, it's Goshima, it's not Goto. I said, yeah, I got it, I got it, I got it. But everywhere I looked, every single document I looked everywhere from 1944 onward said Goto. And I've argued with people, believe it or not, who are saying, I'm wrong. And I'm like, no, the guy who served under Goshima knows it's Goshima. And the unit history that they made like 1978 or something has Goshima written in hiragana next to the kanji in two spots. But I guess they're all wrong. I guess the guy who did the Wikipedia page knows better.
Well, of course, they
So
always know better.
that's the one drawback is you got to fight against information that's wrong, or that since it's been around for so long, it becomes canon. And he's like, well, I'm sorry, that's not true. And what, who cares, right? But in my viewpoint, those guys, they all fought honorably, right,
Yeah.
in their world. And why would you not do anything you could to show the correct pronunciation of the name?
Absolutely.
And it's like Smythe versus Smith, right? My grandfather's name was Smith, but if you kept telling me it was Smythe, I'm like, it's not Smythe, it's Smith, and it matters. So his name was Goshima, Tadao Goshima.
Wow.
And his body was never found either. Yeah.
Have you heard that quote about, I think it's attributed to Hemingway, that every man serves has two deaths? Have you heard of that?
Yes.
That when he dies and goes in the grave, and the time, then the moment that his name is said for the last time. So that's what I love about what you've done here, is that these guys, their names are down. Goshima is down. The name is printed, and they're gonna live long after I'm gone.
That's a, I felt very grateful to Mr. Shimoda that they had that unit history with the names. And the some of the crew members' names, we just couldn't get, we couldn't find them. Or the guys had been replacements and no one had jotted down the new guy's name on the roster that was found. But to the best of our ability, we try to include everybody's name on every tank crew on where they died and where they're from. To the best of our ability, we try to preserve that just for that reason, so that they're dead, but they're not totally forgotten.
Right. Yeah. I think about those just thousands and thousands of Japanese that went into Burma,
Oh, yeah.
the jungles, and they just vanished. Like they're never going to be found. Never. Just thousands and thousands of them. And how sad that is for their families, for just to disappear. Man. They had. They wanted to have a family and they wanted to take care of their parents and and they're just gone.
That's
Have
true.
those guys were, I've seen video of the Marine and the Japanese soldier meeting in their 80s and 90s, and they almost always break down crying when they meet.
Yes.
Have you, what's going on there?
I've seen that on Iwo Jima and Peleliu and Guam with Americans and Japanese, and they meet each other. And what comes across when I translate for them is like, okay, so there's Woody Williams, right?
Yes, sir.
Medal of Honor recipient, right? Iwo Jima. And he met Mr. Akikusa, who is actually on my Iwo Jima book. That's Mr. Akikusa right there. But he and Mr. Akikusa got to meet on top of Mount Suribachi in 2015, and I got to translate for them. And Woody said to Akikusa-san, he said, you and I, we were the only ones who were here that time. Out of everyone on this island right now, all the participants, the Japanese, the Marines, all the family members, they don't know anything about what happened. They really don't. It's just me and you. We're the only two people who were there then that are here now. And they were like shaking their arms, shaking hands, slapping each other and kind of smiling. And I went, this needs to be shared. And there was no animosity, there was no hatred, there was no you blankety blank, you know, blah blah blah. And I saw that on Peterloo with Mr. Tsuchiya and Bill Darling, and they were hugging each other, crying, saying the same thing, you know, because all their friends are dead on both sides, but somehow you are my friend because you were here, and we both experienced the same like horrific thing together. We both
Trauma
survived
bond.
this horrific experience, and it brings us together. And I don't care what you look like. I don't care what language you speak. Your soul survived, mine survived, and they had this weird, weird connection.
Yeah, I
And
mean, that
you saw
is
that on
pretty
Guam too?
I saw it on Guam with Japanese naval pilots, Mr. Harada, who bombed Pearl Harbor. And he was very happy to meet American veterans. And they said jokes like, well, if I knew it was you on that ship, I wouldn't try to drop the bomb. You know, I wouldn't, you know, and they're like, oh, if I knew it was you in that airplane, I wouldn't try to shoot you down, you know. So they say these jokes to each other, but there's underlying mutual respect of meeting someone who survived something horrific, especially when no one around you can understand when you try to talk about it. I don't understand really. I was never
Sure.
in military, never in combat. And like when with my own dad, he was a POW in North Korea. This is his book, The Yellow River Boys. But he would never talk about the war, about shooting at MiG-15s over North Korea, or being captured, or being tortured, or beaten, and all that, unless he was talking to another POW on the phone. And then I would kind of listen in on it as a kid, right? But then if I asked him, he would just get really mad at me. Because you don't understand, you can't understand, you know, just leave me alone. So I think when the veterans can get together on Guam or Peleliu or Iwo Jima, they don't have to explain anything. Each side knows what it was like. There's no like background information. It's just like, you were here, I was here. You know.
Wow. I made a notation in the book here that when he was talking about that he was looking for the tankers and I made a little I wrote in the flyleaf there that I my question was is does Japan seek to if they find remains, do they take DNA from that? Do they get that into it, or is it just a matter of let's bring them and cremate and
You know who was responsible for that was Clint Eastwood. He got that whole ball rolling with that movie. Because up until then, the Japanese government viewed the unrecovered war dead as just something from the past. And so the little veterans' families, or the children, or the grandchildren of the dead vets, would take it upon themselves to go to the Philippines and try to find the bones and personally, privately create little ceremonies for them. And they bring a Buddhist priest, and it was all self-funded. And that went on for a couple of decades. And then when Clint Eastwood's movies came out, there was a huge outcry from the Japanese population saying, why are you not doing more? Why isn't the US government, the Japanese government, doing what the Americans do, finding the bones, doing DNA, and recovering our war dead, who are honorable men? And Clint Eastwood's movie showed the Japanese people, hey, your soldiers were honorable men who fought honorably. You should be proud of them. And until then, their media had always told them, oh, your soldiers are Nanking murderers and baby killers. And they're kind of left wing over there in their media. And it flipped the script on its head. And so all these family groups started demanding action. So now the Japanese government has sponsored groups going to the Palau Islands, Mariana Islands, the Philippines, China, all these places. And I've been really lucky to help them at the Seabee Museum in Point Hueneme. I found a map, an unmarked map that had 1,085 Japanese bodies buried on Peleliu. And it
Wow.
had like a little bitty cross on it in a little square. And I was like, that looks like it could be like a symbol for a grave or something. So we got some finances from the Japanese government, and I went back to Point Hueneme for 2 weeks with two Japanese researchers. We went through thousands of folders, found more evidence, and we presented it to the Japanese. They got money to go to Peleliu. They did a couple of test digs. They found some guys right where they were on this hand-drawn map, and they get 1,085 guys have come out of that gigantic grave
Oh
area.
my
And they're doing
God.
DNA tests on all of them.
I got
And it's a
goosebumps.
massive, massive story. And I got some really nice letters like, oh, King Song, this started with you. And I was like, no, I just happened to be a conduit. I was just trying to help with my friend John Edwards. He passed away, but he and I went to Peterloo like 15 times. And so he and I went to Point Wainini. We're just looking around, see what we could find. And just like something said, here, take this. And it showed it to us. So, and then it went off from there and it had a mind of its own. And one of the Japanese researchers who went there to help dig up the body said, it was like the bodies were calling out all this time to be found and brought home. And
Wow.
I was like, oh, good. I could. Like, I could be involved, right, in a small way.
That is amazing.
And people were driving over them, walking over them. They had
Oh.
like a restaurant on top of that. And I walked over it. I
Wow.
didn't know, right, for all
Yeah.
the times I've been there.
Wow.
Yeah, it's
And they're
pretty
doing
great.
DNA testing too, huh? They're
Yep, they
trying to
sure are.
find
Yep,
who
yep,
they
yep.
were and their families. Do you know of, are they having success with that or
They
that?
found six. As of last month, last time I heard, they found six so far. Because a lot of the drawback is a lot of the siblings are gone, right? And then the parents are all gone. And a lot of the children didn't even know where their father or grandfather died. Because after the war, they said, oh, your father, your grandfather died in the Pacific. And so, whatever, right? So now the Japanese government is placing out calls to say, if you have a loved one who died in the Palau Islands and you'd like to give a DNA sample, we'll take it for free and then we'll be creating a database. So
Oh,
it's slow
man.
going, but they're doing it.
Speaking of
That's amazing.
databases, I just had
They're
a
doing
thought.
it.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it all started with Clint Eastwood. I'm telling you, no joke. He got a Rising Sun Third Class Medal from the Japanese government at the LA Embassy. With the real neck ribbon and the big red thing, and his name is gold over there among the veterans families groups. They have a lot of respect for what he did.
Oh, wow.
I wonder if someone were to take some, maybe some hints, documentation, something that somebody's looked at in the past, try to use this as, here's some evidence of where some graves may be or where someone, a battlefield may have happened where some men died, but they just could not get the results they're looking for. I almost wonder if you digitize that and ran it through ChatGPT or any other sort of AI engine and have them look for patterns or symbolisms or landmarks that we might be able to use that technology. Because obviously DNA was technology that came, through 30 years ago, and now we're using it for good. I almost wonder if we were to digitize some documentation that just has not led anywhere and run it through some AI, if it would help, perhaps lead people to some more discoveries.
And there's a lot of Americans still unrecovered. From Peterloo and Guam, Saipan, and Iwo Jima even, right? Kanaus, haven't found him yet.
What was
Oh,
the
that's
old
right.
documentary from about 15, 20 years ago, Return to Tarawa? And they're talking to the
Oh.
contractor, and he's like, yeah, every time we pour a slab or break ground to put in plumbing, we're pulling up,
Wow.
uniforms. He was talking about how the Japanese are at that time, this is years ago, were repatriating their recovered bodies quicker than the United States was. He was talking about how he had some Marine Corps bodies sitting under his drafting table for an inordinate amount of time before it went away. Yeah, because he's talking to a contractor in that documentary, Return to Tarawa. And he's like, yeah, anywhere you go around here, he's like, you just sift through the gravel and you'll pick up a fingertip or anything. He's like, just because of the destruction, the landmass was so small and the amount of carnage was so large that even 20 years ago, you do any sort of construction and you're more often than not find some sort of remnant.
Jeez.
Got any final questions, Dennis?
Oh, I mean, I have a ton, but we'll save it for another time.
Dan, if you want to go ahead.
I appreciate you guys helping, promote my book. And there's so much in here, like photographs that have never been published
It's a
in the
beautiful
US
book.
or Japan, maps, documents. I even went and shot a Japanese tank machine gun in Las Vegas because Mr. Shimoda was a tank machine gunner. And I found lots of photos in the archives that have never seen the light of day, or they're too common, too boring to make it into a book.
And that's something that we didn't get in the book, but you have
The
all kinds of
organization said,
charts and descriptions and
so it's
even like
someone,
the types of tanks, like all
and the
this
names of the
great
crews, and
stuff. Yeah, they have the names of the crew.
Yeah, I love those types of details. Like I said, I wrote the book for myself. What kind of book would I like to read? And I like to read a book that's got names and details and place and information and the little pranks and jokes and stuff they played on each other. It was stealing things and cigarettes and
I'm glad you brought up the cigarettes because one of the notes I have is there. I mean, granted, this book is it's a book about war, but there are little laugh out loud yourself moments. And one of those moments was the reference to the, oh, this tobacco's got to be from Virginia. It must be good. So just the little things like that.
The smokers like to smoke, right? And they know what tastes good.
And there's probably at least 100 photographs in here, isn't there?
I think so. Yeah, about 100. A lot of them came from Mr. Shimoda. Some came from archives. Others came from other researchers.
I'm telling you, folks, you need to get this book. It is chock full of photographs, graphs, all kinds of really cool illustrations, maps, and the firsthand accounts, which you aren't going to get anywhere else.
Yeah,
Amazing.
and I was thinking the same thing. Obviously, me, Dennis, Jeff, we really key into the Pacific. If your listeners are like us, and you're building a home library like we do, and you have a lot of Pacific Theater War books, you really need to add this one to your library to help
Yes.
round off, as we were talking about earlier, the perception and to get to see the other side. And it's also interesting because there's only so many books out there. There's only so many movies. There's only so many. If you can actually find them, TV series from the 70s and 80s about the topic. And a lot of its stuff, we know it so well because a lot of it's so repetitive and it's so refreshing to get new content about
Thank you.
something that you've known. It's like, okay, we've seen this every other episode, similar. Here's fresh content and it's so impactful information. And once again, you're getting a first person account, you're getting a soldier's story, not propaganda. Not anything else. Now, here's what you should really know. It's just here's what this guy and his crew went through. Here's what it was like at their home. Here's what their family members went through. Here's the struggles. Here's them trying to survive. Now you can see we've read, all the combat and seen it from the American perspective. And you're like, well, what was it like on the other side? Well, now you can read what it was like on the
There
other
you go.
side. And you can get a
Thank you, guys.
well-rounded perspective of some of these campaigns. Dan, where can people find you on the internet? If people
Well, if they want to buy the books, they're all available on Amazon.
are. And we will link to those through WTSPWorldWar2.com. I
Perfect.
know you kind of hinted earlier you have another project in the works because you're always working on projects.
I've got so many in the works. The next one is about the Kaiten suicide submarine pilots. And those were naval aviators who had graduated from their basic training, were preparing to go to flight school, but were diverted over to the submarine program. He said, now you're going to be naval submarine pilot of kamikazes. And they're like, okay, I guess that's what we are now. And so they wore their flight suits, flight helmets, all the flight gear, and they're climbing into little miniature Kaiten submarines, being pilots underwater. And I got those stories coming up, how they trained and what they were told to do. And I've been to their training bases and I interviewed them in their homes.
Now, those
Wow.
submarines, is that similar to the submarine that they have the National Museum Pacific War from Pearl Harbor, or are they smaller than that one?
Smaller. Yeah. The Kaiten is basically a Type 91 torpedo that's got a little cockpit stuffed in the top and it's pulled out just a little bit to put a bigger warhead. And that's it. It's
I
a
never
one
knew that was
man.
a thing. See, here's Dan King bringing more
Tiny.
information about things you didn't
They're
know
tiny.
about.
They have a complete replica at a museum in Japan, and I got to climb inside and see it and play with it and see how tiny it was and the hatch works and everything. And it was, I got photos that'll be in the new book as well.
Were they launched like torpedoes?
They were attached to the deck of a submarine. In fact, the I-58, the one that sunk the USS Annapolis, had torpedoes, these Kaiten torpedoes, on its back. And they're preparing to launch those against the Indianapolis. But the submarine commander had said, no, we've been out at sea a little too long. The bearings that are holding those Kaiten subs to our deck might not release right, and it's going to cause problems. I just want to get this ship. And so he used regular torpedoes to take out the Indianapolis. But the plan was to take them out with these human-guided torpedoes. And I got to interview one of the guys who was a submariner. on the I-58. And he was in the forward
Oh.
torpedo room, Chief Petty Officer Yamada Goro. He was my ex-wife's uncle in Japan, in Gifu. And I
Wow.
interviewed him. And that was like 35 years ago. And I had the little papers in the little envelope. And I was like, I'm glad I saved all that. So I'm going to finally tell his story
Yeah,
about the
well,
Titanic submarine.
we'll definitely have you on for that because my first question is how do you, and obviously we're not going into it now, but it's like talking to a veteran who prepared himself for literally, we often
Yes.
hear the cliche, oh, it was a suicide. No, this literally was, you're being
Yeah,
trained for a actual suicide mission.
100%.
How do you?
And the man you'll be meeting went on a mission. And two of the submarines that were on the deck, the Kaitens, ahead of him, strapped in front of him, both lifted up and took off. And he could watch them through his periscope. But he has two bands holding his Kaiten to the deck. One of them lifted off, the other one was rusted shut. So his
Thank God for
engine, it couldn't.
mechanical malfunctions.
And he was watching and he was like yelling and screaming and hitting the Morse code button, let me go, let me go. And that was it. And they returned back to base. And so he talks about the two men that actually went off on the mission. It's
Wow.
a great story. It's I'm
Yeah,
going to be on
I'm
the
looking
next
forward
book.
to
Yeah.
it.
Now
And so
he
as
survived that mission because of a malfunction.
Wow. Goodness gracious.
Well, thank you for your
Thank
time.
you,
Thank you
guys.
for the books.
Thank you,
It's a
man.
well-written, beautiful book. As
Yeah.
I was saying earlier, for those of you listening, just head over to
Awesome.
WTSPWorldWar2.com. Right on the homepage, you'll see Dan King. You'll see a thumbnail of his book. We'll link to the Amazon. We'll link to his website
Thanks.
and all pertinent information. And as always, we want to hear from you all. Send us an email to mailcall@WTSPWorldWar2.com. We're getting close. I'm going to be out your way here real soon.
Yeah, looking forward to that. Looking forward to
So,
seeing you out here.
be the first time in a while me and Jeff has been occupying the same space, but it'll be the first time ever that Dennis and I have occupied the same space. But I was thinking about this the other day, Dennis. We've been doing this so long that to me it feels like, oh, we're gonna get together and hang out as if we went to high school or together. It's like
Yeah.
I don't feel like you and I have never occupied the same physical space, but we
Yeah.
haven't. But it just we've been
Yeah.
doing this so long. I just feel like, oh yeah, Dennis and I went to high school together. It's just been a few years, but we're gonna have a reunion. But no, we will actually be occupying the same space, me, Jeff, and Dennis, and a very fantastic event coming up in San Antonio, which you guys can go back to the last episode to get more detail on it. Dan, thank you so much for your time. And as
Thank you,
always,
guys.
for myself and Dennis and Jeff, who wish he could have been here, we'll talk to you all next week.
This has been a Digital 410 production.